Okay, thanks so much. Thank you for inviting me, and it's great to be here to talk about some of this. So the context for this talk is we have a bunch of data from ground-based CMB surveys, which I'm involved in analyzing, so I work on the ACTPOL experiment. But also for the next five and 10 years, we're going to be upgrading ACT to the Advanced ACT Survey, and we're currently planning the successors, Simons Observatory, which is the ACT and polar bear teams coming together, and then CMB Stage 4, which is kind of the whole North American ground-based CMB community coming together to make a much larger scale, higher budget experiment than before. So I'm involved in planning that and thinking about what we can do with that. So I'll be talking about ongoing analyses and also some challenges and opportunities going forward with these data sets. Where it's more of a theoretical work, thinking 5 or 10 years into the future. Okay, so here's this the time scale, and then this is the raw the sort of sensitivity. So this is Moore's law for CMB experiments. So the first generations of SPT and ACT are written are shown here in green. Each generation is another order of magnitude in detectors. So since you are photon shot noise limited with these detectors, the noise in this survey is basically set by how many detectors you can cram into a focal plane. So something like stage four, which is going to be in the 2020s, will not just be one telescope, but many telescopes, because there's a physical limit to how many detectors you can fit into a focal plane. So we're currently analyzing stage two data, so I'll show some of the ACTPOL data. There's also the SPT poll and polar bear surveys. We're starting to look at the Advanced ACT, and SPT3G just got started. Simons Array has also just recently gotten started, because we're now here at 2017. And then CMBS4, like I said, is the whole community coming together. So just to get a picture of what we gain by reducing the noise, but also by working from the ground, having very high angular resolution, here's a patch, a 30 square degree patch from WMAP with its half a degree or so angular resolution, down to seven arc minutes with Planck for the same patch of sky. You see more features. But then when you come to the ground with a one arc minute experiment, you see many more features in the CMB here, and also you see things popping out at you that you hadn't seen before. So these are some bright millimeter wave galaxies, and up here is actually a Sunyaev-Zel'dovich galaxy cluster. So this is a dark spot in the CMB where there's been an upscattering in the CMB photons in that direction. So they've been scattered up out of this particular wave band. So it appears as a dark spot. So what's exciting about all these surveys is in addition to measuring the primary anisotropies and looking for primary B modes, all the things that we can do by thinking about the CMB as a backlight. So I really like this slide because this kind of encapsulates almost everything that I think about in a single picture. So if you have CMB photons coming in, to the observer down here, they might get scattered in a hot galaxy, in a massive galaxy cluster with the Sunyaev-Zel'dovich effect. They might see the effects of dark energy through the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect when the potentials decay when dark energy turns on. There can be a Doppler effect between pairs of lines of sight where you're probing the kinematic Sunyaev-Zel'dovich effect and moving electrons. The Vishniac is something similar. Then there's the gravitational lensing, which I'll spend most, or if not all, of the time talking about, where if you look closely, this path here is bent slightly. So the observer is seeing the photons coming from a slightly different direction than where they're actually coming from. Patch reionization is also a kinetic Sunyaev-Zel'dovich effect happening earlier on during reionization. Okay. So the outline, as I said for the talk, is I'll talk about some ongoing analyses. So that's ACTPOL, and then future data, the timelines here, Advanced ACT, Simons Observatory, CMBS4, and just for some rough numbers, this is the noise. So this is the noise level in the maps. The power spectrum noise goes like the square of this. The target for CMBS4 is 1 μK arc minute, compared to the current data that we have, 12 to 15 or so. And over the next few years, we'll be pushing these noise levels down more and more, and also we'll be surveying more and more of the sky. So we'll be pushing up to half of the sky, which is really, if you're at this in this, say in the South Pole, that's all the sky that you can see. In Chile, you can see a little bit more, but then there's the galactic cut that is not useful. So we're talking about huge parts of the sky, a very good sensitivity and very good angular resolution. Okay, so on the data analysis side, everything I'm going to show is very collaborative, so I just wanted to show my collaborators. Blake and Nalima and Matt and myself are the sort of lensing working group within the ACPOL team. Matt is going to be coming here in a couple years as a postdoc, so you should look forward to that. He's great. And then this is the entire ACPOL collaboration. So Lyman Page here is the principal investigator. He's a faculty at Princeton. Okay, and I've also been thinking about some more theoretical questions with this group here. So some of the work I'll show is with these people. So I work very closely with Dan and Joel, and also Dan Green. We worked for a summer with Connor Shear, who did a great job on a project that I hope I'll have time to talk about, and also with Kendrick. Okay, so this is a series of slides which was made by a collaborator of mine, Sigurd Ness, which I really like because it kind of shows everything that goes on with the CMB, as he says, from pristine CMB to dirty data. So we're gonna track this as it goes across the universe. So we're starting at recombination. So we have temperature, E-mode polarization, and then he has put in a small amount of B-mode polarization, as you would expect if you had inflationary gravitational waves. And so you can keep track of what's happening. If you're interested in large-scale B-modes, you can keep track of what's happening to these B-modes as we traverse the universe here. So here we go. So the first thing that will happen is the gravitational lensing. So the gravitational lensing, as I said, moves features on the CMB surface around. It also breaks the symmetry, so you have a very particular symmetry where the scalars are sourcing these E modes, but not the B modes. When you have lensing, you break that symmetry and you convert some of these E into B, and this is the size of that effect. So you induce a bunch of small scale B mode fluctuations, and removing these small scale B mode fluctuations is an active field known as delensing to try to reduce not just the signal, but the variance associated with these B modes. Okay, and then there are dusty galaxies, radio sources, and SZ clusters. So as I said, you can have bright spots in the temperature are galaxies, dark spots are SZ clusters. And then in the polarization, since the E and B are non-local transformations, these things show up as these quadrupolar patterns here. Okay. And then there can be a small amount of Faraday rotation as in the galaxy's magnetic field as the photons come into the galaxy. But that should be pretty small. And then there's galactic dust and synchrotron. So that can really affect the B modes here, but also the temperature in E.
Now,
go ahead. Yeah, it's just the scale. So plus and minus 520 in 1 micro K. Yeah. So for precision work, of course, the dust will affect the temperature as well. Okay. And then there's atmospheric emission. So this is the end of the astrophysics, and now we have what you actually get at the telescope. So if you're on the ground, you have atmospheric emission that can affect the temperature, and also some of that can leak through to the polarization. Which is why we have these half-wave plates to try to block that out in the polarization. If you have an offset of the polarization angles, then your bases that define your E and B are not correct, and so you can get this kind of effect with E to B leakage. So we have to be very careful with the calibration of these angles. Finally, telescope optics with a side lobe, so that Sigurd has put in a big side lobe here, which can mess things up. And then you add in detector noise. And then there can be glitches in the data also. So there can be tiny spikes of short duration but large amplitude that need to be taken out. Okay. And so this is the data then as you see it. Of course, you don't see it this way. You see it as a time-ordered data, which you have to project onto the map. Okay, so going way back to the gravitational lensing, so how do we measure the gravitational lensing? We look for the statistical changes in the distribution of these hot and cold spots.
Just out of curiosity, yeah. What R, you know, tensor to scalar ratio would that correspond to?
I'm not sure. Plus or minus one micro K. I don't know off the top of my head. I think he probably would have done something reasonable within the current constraints.
I'm hoping you were going to say it's very small.
Very small.
It looks very hard.
Yeah, that's the takeaway message. Measuring B modes is extremely hard. But measuring any of this stuff is hard, right? So the gravitational lensing also has been, at the final end of this sequence, it was also hard to see the gravitational lensing, right? Okay, so the way that we're looking for the gravitational lensing is we look for statistical changes. So in the distribution of these hot and cold spots. So in some places, if you look at what the lensing was doing, it was taking these hot and cold spots, making them larger or smaller. That's when that's a convergence. So that's when you're looking through a matter over or under density. In other places, it's shearing it out. So it's doing an anisotropic distortion where it becomes sheared out longer in one direction and shorter in the other direction. And that's what our lensing reconstruction is looking for. It's also turning where it's turning E into B. That's also another thing that we look for. In particular, there's then a correlation between the E modes you're starting with and the B modes that you generate. So these quadratic estimators, it's an E correlated with B to look for that effect, or you can do something like T correlated with itself, where you're locally measuring the power spectrum. So you're looking at the shape, the power spectrum is just the distribution of the hot and cold spots, and you're looking for anisotropy in that. So you're looking for, is the CMB stretched or squeezed locally in the power spectrum? And that's what that TT quadratic estimator is doing. So that's here. So for instance, if you are looking through a spot where a hot or cold spot would be sheared out vertically, if you locally compute the power spectrum on that part of the sky, here it is in 2D Fourier space, so this is LX and LY. You'll find, and these are the fringes of the acoustic peaks, you'll find that the fringes are stretched down because this is the Fourier conjugate of that. And so locally measuring the power spectrum in this way is how you would tag shearing going on in the map. And so that's what these quadratic estimators from Hu and Okamoto, which people in this field run, are actually, this is the physical effect that they're looking for. Okay. So we. So this is a cartoon. No one actually, this is the squeeze limit. So this is where you're actually locally measuring the power spectrum. The generalization to reconstructing a Fourier mode of the lensing field is what's actually done in the Hu and Okamoto papers. And that's optimal. The Hu and Okamoto reconstruction combines in an optimal way the shearing information and the convergence information. But when you go into the squeeze limit where you're just looking at local patches and looking at if you're assuming the wavelength of the lensing field is much larger than the wavelength of the CMB you're looking at, there you can cleanly separate these effects because you can separate the shear estimation from the convergence estimation. But the Hu Nakamoto thing is optimal. Okay, so this is the status of these measurements sometime last year when we wrote up the CMB Stage 4 science book, which came out last October. So you can see there's a peak here. This is a 40 sigma measurement from the Planck team. It peaks at about L of 40. And then it falls off. And so this is in the temperature using that TT estimator. This is the polarization using the EB estimator. I worked for my PhD thesis. I did these green points with the SPT telescope. But then a couple years later, the Planck team came along and blew us all out of the water with this 40 sigma measurement down here. However, there is a lot of room to gain here. So the Planck does not have a lot of signal to noise per mode. It actually has at best order unity right down here. So the noise curve sort of does this. So the signal to noise per mode is about one right at the peak here. And the rest of the spectrum, it's all actually noise dominated for Planck. Whereas for SPT or ACT, we actually measure with signal to noise much greater than one, the large scales, but then we don't currently have as much sky. So the plan going forward is to have very good signal to noise measurements over large fractions of the sky to start to get into the Causing Variance limit here. And also to move towards polarization. So currently there have been detections in polarization, but not as good as the temperature. Okay. And the reason to do this, of course, is to try to measure the neutrino mass. So the number to have in mind is that every change in the neutrino mass of 0.1 eV is something like a 5% change in the lensing power spectrum. The reason is you have some part of the matter budget that does not cluster, and so it slows down the growth of fluctuations and gives you a smaller amplitude for the matter power spectrum than you would have if you didn't have massive neutrinos. This is a plot which I made for the science book. Changing the neutrino mass, this is the three-dimensional matter power spectrum. It's not normally plotted in linear coordinates, but this is what it looks like with this peak here at the equality scale. And the CMB lensing is really just taking this thing and it has a broad redshift distribution, but if you imagine just taking the 3D matter power spectrum and putting it at redshift 2, you get about what you get. In this two-dimensional projection. So the CMB lensing potential keeps most of the sensitivity to the neutrino mass, but projects it down into a two-dimensional power spectrum. And this is the relative change as you change the neutrino mass. And all of our measurements are, most of our constraining power is in this part of the spectrum where it's really just well approximated by a constant amplitude here. So we're not looking for the change in the shape down here because these modes at L of 10s are cosmic variance limited. But we can gain many, many more modes up here and compare the amplitude at this redshift 2, to the amplitude at primordial times at last scattering. Okay. So I'll say a bit about the data analysis for the ACT poll survey, where we put out these results last November, I think. So I'll show some of that. So here's a picture of the ACT telescope. So this is a 6-meter dish down in Chile. Normally when you see if you do a Google image search, you'll see a picture taken from the ground, but that's actually this ground screen. It's not the telescope. The telescope is this thing sitting inside. And you see the mountains here in the background. So the ACT poll survey. So in the first season, we imaged these small pink patches around the equator. So four deep fields using a single array. The second year, there was another array added, so the camera became more sensitive. And we started surveying larger patches of the sky. So we spent a lot of time analyzing this patch right here, which is this larger yellow patch on the equator, and also taking data around here. And this is to optimize overlap, in particular with redshift surveys, BOSS. And also some patches down here in the south where the foregrounds aren't as bad. That came around in the third season. But I'll show some results that are all coming from this part right here. So as I said, there are these two small patches and this one wider patch. And so here are the maps. These two were scanned in the first season, and then this larger thing was scanned in the second season. The reason it has this shape is that the scan directions, we scan it as it's rising, and then it goes like this, and then we scan it as it's setting. So that sets these two directions. So the scans come either this way or sort of this way. And the same thing here, that's what sets the funny geometry that you see on the border. Okay. So there was a power spectrum analysis done for these data. You can see, so in red is ACT poll and in blue is Planck, so they agree well with each other. The feature of the ACT poll data is that the polarization measurements become better than Planck on small angular scales down here. So you see that we can start to measure the damping scale down here at L of a couple thousand in ACT poll better than Planck. Okay, so some science results from ACT poll that I won't have time to talk about.
I actually have some questions. It seems from the previous plot that the high L
I think it's consistent. I'm not sure what's going on there. There's some weak evidence for a bit of excess actually down here for polarized. There are polarized point sources up here, but for this particular curve, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Okay. So some other science results that we've put out, which I don't have time to talk about. So a cross correlation between the large scale velocities obtained from the BOSS survey, where you turn the galaxy density into the galaxy velocity. So Kendrick worked on this, together with Emmanuel Shan, who is the leader on this project. And then correlating that with the kinetic SZ of these galaxies. So that was a 3.2 sigma measurement. There was also a similar thing, but with the pairwise momentum statistic, where you take pairs of galaxies and look at how they're falling in towards each other using the kinetic SZ effect. Another thing that Matt led was the first detection of lensing of the CMB by individual dark matter halos, which he obtained a nice first detection of. Okay. But I'll be talking about the reconstruction of the large-scale convergence. So here are the reconstructed convergence maps of the CMB maps that I showed a few slides ago. So season one, there were three of those little patches, and then that wider field. So the most of this is noise, but there is a little bit of real dark matter fluctuation in this map. Okay, whoops. So the first thing we did in the first season when we had just those small patches was to take a cross correlation with the cosmic infrared background, so the dusty star-forming galaxies at redshifts 1 to 2. And this was nice because it exists everywhere on the sky, and we could also compare with what other surveys were getting. So our points were here in red. The Planck team had a much tighter measurement of this in these purple points. And then a simple theory line that goes through the curve, that matches the CIB data, matches this cross correlation as well, this solid green curve. Okay. But then the exciting thing that we've put out just a few months ago, as I said, is the measurement of the auto spectrum coming from ACT. So you take those three patches, and you run these different quadratic estimators on it. So you can do the TT one, which for the time being has the most sensitivity. But looking forward to future data, we wanted to get in the habit of doing the polarization reconstructions too, because that's what's going to have the most significance going forward as the noise in these surveys gets better. So you can make these four lensing reconstructions, and then using these different estimators, and then you can do all the cross power spectra between each of those lensing measurements. And that means you're measuring four different types of four-point functions in the CMB. And so that's what's shown here. So the best one is the TT cross TT, which is way up here. And then the least sensitive one is the EB cross with itself. But this will be the one that will be sort of the dominant science channel for CMB S4. Then there are all these other, you can do all the different pairings. We gain a bit of signal to noise by taking the TT one and adding it in with these polarization ones. So most of the weight comes from this top row up here. But we did do the consistency checks with all these other panels as well. Okay. And if you combine now all the data together, we get this. So this is the two-season ACPOL lensing measurement. It's only about 10% of all the data that were taken at the time that the paper came out last November. If you restrict yourself to nighttime data, which is when the beams are the most stable, so during the day the telescope heats up, and the beam is not as stable, so we haven't studied that effect as much. We've only worked with nighttime data, so this is only about 20% of the nighttime data. And about a 15% measurement of the amplitude of this curve. Okay. And we ran through some cosmological constraints, so to look for consistency with other data sets. So this is the status of lensing measurements. The ACPOL is this wide red banana. The Planck one from 2015 is consistent with that in gray. And then these optical lensing surveys are sensitive to a slightly different combination of sigma 8 and omega matter. So they're steeper in this direction, but you see that we are consistent with those as well, which isn't surprising because our banana is the biggest one in this panel. Okay, and then this is just looking looking at these other comparisons. So if you, the Planck primary CMB is way in here in yellow. Just the lensing plus BAO is giving you some, so this is from the Boss survey, this is giving you some measurement of omega matter and sigma 8. Okay, so I'd like to go forward and talk about some things we're thinking about in the going into the future. So the Advanced ACPOL survey has recently begun in 2016. This is where you have many more frequencies, so 5 frequencies, and a much more sensitive camera, and it will survey half the sky. So the plan is to overlap with the entire, so LSST is this whole region here, and the plan is to cover a substantial fraction of the LSST footprint to do all these kinds of cross-correlations at much higher significance than a few sigma that I've shown so far. Following the Advanced ACPOL survey, as I said, we'll be joining forces with the Polar Bear team to build some new telescopes and new detectors to do the same thing to higher sensitivity, and we're in the planning stages of determining exactly which frequencies and beam sizes, dish sizes we need for that. Okay, so the Advanced ACT survey will be something like 220 sigma measurement of this amplitude compared to 40 sigma for Planck. So about 40 millielectron volt constraint on the neutrinos. So one thing I've spent a fair amount of time thinking about is what do you get from foregrounds. So there are, if you're using temperature in this reconstruction, which is what we'll be doing for the time being, you're measuring the four-point function of the CMB induced by lensing, but there are other four-point functions coming in from extragalactic sources. So in particular, the SZ effect has a trispectrum because you're looking at the shot noise in massive galaxy clusters. The CIB also has a four-point function, which has many contributions coming from the gravitational clustering of these objects to the way that the galaxies live inside their parent dark matter halos. There's also a contribution from things like three-point functions, so the CIB-CIB phi three-point function, for example, where you think about a long wavelength mode in the density modulating the power spectrum, the small scale power spectrum of the CIB. So these kind of contributions actually come in as biases on this lensing measurement at the order of several percent. So this is the fractional bias on the CMB lensing. The target for these surveys is to get down to about 1% precision, but you see that these curves are giving us biases of several percent. And the size of these error bars is giving the theory and some indication of the theory uncertainty. So running different simulations, different models, gives you order unity differences in these biases. So it's clear that it's important to have multi-frequency. So all these things depend on frequency in particular ways. This is all at a single frequency, so it's good to have multi-frequency data is a takeaway point from this. And there are other tricks to try to estimate, to try to jointly estimate these four-point functions as well as the lensing four-point functions and try to separate them out directly.
Is there anything magic about L2000 and the L2 zero there, or is it just a coincidence?
No, that's the response of a single point source. So if you compute what, if you have your filters set for the CMB lensing, and then if you put in a single point source, it has this particular shape. And then the SZ and CIB fields are basically superpositions of many, effectively, point sources. Even the SZ clusters are basically point sources on the scales that we care about. And this looks really scary up here, but most of our signal to noise is at L of 1500 and below. Okay, and then there's going farther into the future with CMB S4, and this is something like a 500 sigma lensing measurement. So here, I made this plot for the S4 science book. You can't even see the error bars on this upper plot. So if you go in here and look at the change as a function of the neutrino mass, so the forecasted S4 error bars are here in gray. The cosmic variance limit is in blue. So you see we're actually sample, the plan for CMB S4 is to be sample variance limited up to L of 1000. And it's sample variant. The only difference between down here between the blue and gray is the fact that we only have 40% of the sky. So this is the full sample variance limit up to L of 1,000 before it starts becoming noise dominated on these smaller scales. And then, as I said, changing the neutrino mass basically just changes the overall amplitude here. So each of these red curves is for a different neutrino mass. Okay. So the target is to get to something like 20 or 30 millielectron volts together with external data. So we need to have a measurement of the BAO, need to give us a measurement of the dark matter density, and we also need an external measurement of the tau from reionization, which I'll get back to in a little bit. Okay. So something that I've been thinking about lately is, so the main channel for this is the polarization. And something that we don't know about, but that we're concerned about, is the degree to which the dust in the galaxy and the synchrotron in the galaxy in polarization can be non-Gaussian and can impact this measurement. The concern here is we don't really have data. So the Planck survey images the intensity of the dust very well, all the way down to the scales that we care about. But the measurements of the polarization are really only good on large angular scales and not the angular scales that we need for the lensing. So there's an uncertainty in the size of the non-Gaussianity of the polarized galactic dust on small scales. So I'm doing this project right now with some other collaborators where we've taken a number of different models for what the galactic dust would be doing in polarization on small scales and running it through the quadratic estimator to look at the size of the biasing. So what you see here is for one particular model where it's a simulation where you put in this turbulent magnetic field, which sets the polarization angles of the dust. Each of these lines is a different line of sight through the galaxy. And the thing to keep in mind is we're talking about huge fractions of the sky. So it's impossible when you're doing this to avoid some parts of the sky that have a fair amount of dust in them. So when you run it through this quadratic estimator, you see a huge dispersion in the effective bias that comes from the galactic dust. The black curve is the signal. Now there's a handful of these curves where it's of order the signal, which is really scary. The bulk of them are way down here and are negligible, according to this model. But if you compute the mean, you see something that's only a factor of 10 or so smaller than the theory curve. So this is a work in progress, but this is a potential concern. And so the reason for doing this is to determine how many frequency channels we need for this particular survey. So this is assuming you only have one frequency. And so one of the upshots of this study will be to recommend to the S4 team how many frequencies to put on the telescope. Each red line is a different line of sight through the sky. So the lower ones have very little dust. And then these upper ones are somewhere near the galactic plane, but still in a part of the sky that one would use for CMB analysis. And it's a four-point function. So there's some spread in the amount of dust power, but now the spread in the four-point function is like the square of that. So that's why there's so many orders of magnitude that these different patches of sky are going through. Okay. And then the same thing up here for the temperature, if you just do the reconstruction on the temperature. Okay. How are we doing for time? Oh, so we're till 12? Good. Okay, so this is the neutrino sensitivity for S3 and S4. So this is from Allison et al. This is if you free up the other cosmological parameters. So as a standard model that one would try to constrain would be just lambda CDM plus neutrinos, but then you can ask how model dependent is this? In particular, if I free up other parameters, how much do I degrade my neutrino mass constraint? For example, dark energy equation of state is also known to affect the growth rate of structure, so there's a non-zero correlation there. This is at 60 millielectron volts, this is the minimum sum of the neutrino masses that we know from oscillation experiments. So each of these lines is, this would be a 2 sigma, 3 sigma, and 4 sigma constraint if, in fact, the total sum of the neutrino masses is just 60 millielectron volts. And the colors to look at here are S4 in yellow and S3 in green. And the thing is, there isn't a huge difference between these, even though there are many more detectors going into S4 compared to S3. I have a better view of that here. So this plot is a bit scary for this, or a little, it is what it is, but the neutrino mass from CMB S4 is going to be tau limited. So if we need to get a measurement of tau in order to know the amplitude of structure at an early time, so at the time that of CMB last scattering, because really the constraint on the neutrino mass comes from comparing the amplitude at some low redshift compared to the amplitude at some high redshift for the amplitude of density fluctuations. And then the high redshift ones are highly correlated or are indistinguishable from changing the optical depth through reionization. So the current constraint from Planck is somewhere at the top of this plot. The Planck Blue Book value, which is what the raw sensitivity of the Planck survey could have if there were no foregrounds to deal with on large scales and polarization, is somewhere here, 10 to the minus 6 on the error on tau. And then a cosmic variance limit. So if you can measure the Lowell E modes to cosmic variance, then you would have an error of 0.002. And now these contours are showing you what the neutrino mass constraints are in this parameter space of the error on tau and then the noise in the survey. And to orient you, current surveys are somewhere up here, and then CMB S4 is down here at about 1 micro K arc minute. And you see we do much, much better if we can improve the tau value than turning down the noise in the CMB survey. Okay. Yeah.
And 60 MeV millielectron volts was the total sum in the 50-50 inverted?
That's for the normal hierarchy. Yeah. So the inverted one is about twice that. So at these noise levels, we can start ruling out the inverted hierarchy using cosmology. Okay, so this motivates getting a better measurement of tau very strongly, because a lot of time and money is being spent on going down in this direction. But clearly, we would gain if we could get another measurement of tau. So there are upcoming space-based surveys which are currently in the planning stages. So there's LightBird, which is a Japanese-led survey. There's from the ground. Johns Hopkins is leading a project called CLASS, which is aiming to measure the Lowell polarization from the ground, which has never been done before, in order to get a new measurement of this. But it's very challenging, particularly with the systematics, to try to measure polarization on large scales when you have large-scale synchrotron fluctuations, for example.
And then the actual
it's right at the top here, 0.01 or actually 0.012. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, both. Yeah. But the fact that the central value keeps changing just indicates how difficult this measurement is from the systematics point of view. The central value has evolved a lot over the various generations of the WMAP release and then finally Planck. Okay, so we had this idea of... So motivated by this, this is a project that I did with Kendrick and Don and Joel. And the idea was to reconstruct the Lowell E modes using the gravitational lensing effect. So with these surveys, we will have exquisite maps of B modes induced by lensing and reconstructed maps of the lensing field itself. So Kendrick had this idea. Well, some amount of the B modes are actually coming from the lensing of the Lowell features in the E. So this is the Lowell E mode power spectrum coming from reionization. And then these different curves are for different values of tau. This is the one sigma uncertainty allowed by Planck right now, is the size of this error band. And so so we started thinking about, you know, is it possible to try to reconstruct this? If you have a map of the B modes that these and the lensing field that are generated by lensing, so the B modes are generated by lensing, you have a map of the lensing field itself, you should be able to reconstruct the E modes as well. And so that's what this calculation is. So this is the reconstruction noise. So this is the noise per mode that you would get in a futuristic survey if you were to do this reconstruction. And so sadly, we saw that it was very, very futuristic. So in order to image this, you need a couple orders of magnitude below, in terms of noise level below what we're forecasting for CMBS4. But in principle, it is something that at the very least is not subject to understanding large-scale systematics in the polarization. Sadly, it's not as within reach as we were hoping. Okay. Oh, here's the constraint on tau. So the current value from Planck, and then the cosmic variance limit as a function of the noise in the survey. So CMBS4 is here. We only get as good as Planck for a couple orders of magnitude lower than CMBS4. But as I said, it is at least independent of large scale foregrounds. We also did something similar recently with reconstructing the dipole, where you can try to think about reconstructing the L equals 1 primordial dipole by looking at the measurement of the lensing field and also the measurement of the temperature into which that dipole gets lensed. So you can ask me about that later if you're interested. Okay. Another thing I've thought about, a little bit about is the delensing of the CMB, where for large-scale B modes, here are the lensing B modes, and then the B modes induced by tensors for different values of the tensor amplitude. And it will be crucial to delens, so to get rid of these lensing B modes by taking a lensing map and undoing the lensing operation. And it's not just to reduce this signal, but more importantly, to reduce the variance associated with the fluctuations in that. So Kendrick is one of the pioneers of this topic. So here's a plot from one of Kendrick's papers. This is the improvement on the error bar on R, so the tensor amplitude, as a function of the parameters of the delensing survey. So you see it becomes very important to do this delensing for B modes. So that's well known, and that's something I'm working on thinking about for practicalities for future surveys. Something else that I've worked on is a paper called Delensing Beyond the B Modes. And the idea here is that lensing also smears the acoustic peaks. So the acoustic peaks in the CMB are these very sharp features. And lensing smears them out. So lensing is shifting the fluctuations around on the CMB surface and making these acoustic peaks less sharp. What we thought about was if it's possible to sharpen up these acoustic features. And we derived the forecasting tools to do that. And then we computed how well a futuristic survey would be able to sharpen up these acoustic features. So the fully lensed difference is here in blue. And then for different surveys, you see you get almost back to the unlensed curve here in red. So these different green curves are showing you that you get almost down to the, you can almost fully recover the unlensed CMB. And so why would you want to do that? So here are associated constraints in the aneffective and helium abundance. So both of these parameters are changing the scale of the silk damping. And the aneffective is additionally changing the acoustic scale. So the phase of the acoustic peaks is a sensitive function of the amount of radiation, free streaming radiation before recombination. It's not just neutrinos, but it's any other species that's free streaming that's at some time in thermal equilibrium with the standard model particles. And we show that if you de-lens, you can improve in this parameter space basically for free. So you have these lensing maps. If you de-lens the small scale temperature and E-mode acoustic peaks, you can improve your constraints on these two parameters. So that brings you from, for CMB stage four, that brings you from this red ellipse down to this blue one. And then for context, the current constraint in this parameter space is from Planck, it's this gray ellipse here. Okay, I'd like to quickly tell you about one other thing I've been working on in the last few minutes. And that's thinking about whether we can look for B modes from primordial tensors in a new way. And that's the B omega correlation, which I'll sketch out for you right now. And as I said, this is a project led by a summer student that was at CETA last summer. So if you have a universe with primordial gravitational waves, as you know, you get this tensor B-mode power spectrum. So this is the B-modes in the CMB polarization. It's red or blue curve here, depending on the amplitude of the tensors. You also get a signal in these B-modes, or I'll call them curl modes, of gravitational lensing. So this is where you have, in the presence of a gravitational wave, a packet of photons can get a net rotation as it comes towards you, giving you effective B modes in the shear patterns on the sky coming from gravitational lensing. And so similarly, this is the amplitude in a universe with primordial gravitational waves. Now the noise curves that we have from realistic surveys are up here. So this is a few orders of magnitude below the noise, unlike this one where we're actively targeting the B modes from polarization. The B modes in the gravitational lensing are way below the noise. But you can ask, are these two things correlated? And so this hadn't been done before for the CMB. But the same gravitational waves that are sourcing these B modes from reionization, so around redshift 10, are also going to generate some B modes in the gravitational lensing, or curl modes. Yeah. Right, so the foregrounds in the polarized dots should affect this one. It won't affect this one because to reconstruct a large scale mode in the lensing field, you're actually using a pair of very small scale modes. So it doesn't directly affect this one, it affects it only through the three-point function going out to small scales in the lensing field.
So you anticipate
Do I anticipate them? I don't know if they exist or not, but we are looking for them in this channel, and so it's worth thinking about how else would we be able to see them. Okay, so this is a sketch of the cross correlation between these two. So these are the B mode, the B and then curl mode lensing source function. So if you have primordial gravitational waves, you will generate B modes on large scales from reionization. So this is the peak in this source function is telling you where that signal is coming from. So at redshift 9 or so, and then on large scales, so 10 to the minus 3 in K. And then in the right panel is the analogous source function for these curl modes in the gravitational lensing. And so since there's some overlap between these two, we do in fact expect a cross power spectrum. And so this is what we calculated in this project. For the CMB, it's up here in red. And if you put a source down, so many different sources can be lensed and can have curl modes in the lensing. So we considered a source at redshift 1100, so that would be the CMB. A source at redshift 50, which would be the dark ages. A source at redshift 8, which would be reionization. And then what had actually been considered before for this is a source screen at redshift 1.4 or so, which would be a optical cosmic shear survey. And you see, because if you put the source farther and farther away, you're capturing more and more of this overlap. In particular, you'd like to have a source that's well behind reionization to capture as much of this overlap as possible. So that's why this cross power spectrum is going up significantly as you put the source of these photons that are getting lensed farther and farther away from you. Okay. And then we considered the detection prospects. So this is the signal to noise in an in-principle sense. So if there was no noise on either the CMB or, more importantly, on the curl gravitational lenses, as a function of the redshift of the source. So the CMB is at redshift 1100. There's a peak here during the dark ages. There's another small peak during reionization at redshift 8 or 10. Now, this had been considered previously only at redshift around 1 or 2. And so the takeaway point of this paper is that we, you know, there is a larger signal if you go out to higher redshift. And so we showed that for the first time. Sadly, because you have a very limited number of modes, so you're only going up to L of 20 or so in your probing reionization. And so that means it's very hard to detect because you're just fighting against cosmic variance. But a futuristic Dark Ages survey should, in principle, be able to see this. And it's extremely futuristic, but it would be a confirmation that if you saw B modes in your CMB survey, that they actually were coming from primordial tensors. OK. So I'd like to summarize what I've said. OK, so first I showed you the 7 sigma results from ACPOL lensing with much more data in the can. And we're working hard on getting a new result that will be much higher than significance than 7 sigma. And we'll start to approach the statistical weight of the 40 sigma measurement coming from Planck, but then in a complementary sense because it will be on smaller angular scales. So it will actually be giving us some new information. Then we're looking forward towards the advanced ACPOL, Simons Observatory, which is a few years off, CMBS4, which is 7 or 8 years off, hundreds of sigmas on this measurement. I talked about some of the challenges, so extragalactic foregrounds in the case of temperature, galactic foregrounds in the case of polarization, where it's for CMBS4, it's going to be polarized. The polarization will dominate the information. We know the measurement is tau limited, so we would do extremely well if we could get a better measurement of tau. So I sketched out one idea that we worked out, which is to reconstruct the low L E modes using the data that we will have. I talked about de-lensing T, E, and B to try to sharpen up the constraints on the physics that sets the acoustic fluctuations on small scales, in particular the number of degrees of the number of radiative degrees of freedom, and then I also talked about this very futuristic thing where you try to confirm if the B modes you see are actually coming from gravitational waves using this cross correlation with cosmic shear. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
First part of the question is not obvious to me why that is, since in the first slides you showed the polarization is so much weaker. And second part of the question is if the dust or whatever turns out to be terrible, so you can't use it, and you would only use the temperature, how good would it be?
Right. So let's see, which slide should I go back to? So the reason is that we're starting out from a very highly symmetric configuration of, let's see. Yeah, so this is all coming from polarization. We're starting with a very symmetric configuration where we have, if you can neglect, for this purpose, you can neglect any primary B modes. And so you're starting with only E modes on the sky, and then they get lensed into B. So where you see B, you know that it's coming from lensing. Whereas in the temperature, you're always fighting against the intrinsic fluctuations that you know that are already there in the temperature. So that's where the extra information comes from. The thing is that the B modes from lensing are very weak, and so we need a very low noise survey to get there, and that's what CMBS4 will be. So we only have so far we only have first marginal detections of the lensing and the polarization, which I have a slide of somewhere here, right? So all these other panels, which are everything except for this one, but with the current data, they are not yet competitive. Okay. And then, so your second question was, what if we're not able to use the polarization? So that would be, so the plan is to make enough frequency channels to deal with foregrounds and remove this effect. So the plot that I showed was only working at a single frequency. So this is an absolute crazy scenario where you would only put one frequency. This is the first thing to look at is what would you get if you only had a single frequency? And indeed, in some parts of the sky, it looks like the biases here are significant. But even having a few frequency channels should knock this down significantly. And the question is, do we need 3 or 5 or 7 different frequency channels for this? So that's the question we're trying to go after. Yeah?
It's all this new observation. What can we know about the theory of repetition?
The theory of cosmology? Yeah, I've only talked about very standard extensions to the lambda CDM model. So the main things I talked about were turning on massive neutrinos, which we already know neutrinos have mass, we just don't know how massive. Turning on inflationary gravitational waves. And then the number of effective degrees of freedom or radiation-like species prior to recombination, which would rule out having an upper limit on that would rule out a whole host of alternative models in particle physics, because you'd rule out entire sectors of things that are in equilibrium with the standard model prior to recombination. We haven't spent as much time. There are some sections actually in the CMBS 4 science book, but I haven't been so involved in thinking about more exotic things, cosmic strings, cosmic birefringence, and so on. But there are constraints that are possible with these surveys for that as well.
The angle of the polarization of TT is now known to 50% six standard parameters. So it's difficult to see how you officially get more and more accuracy. But you pretty well know what the situation is.
Yeah, the temperature information will be saturated in a few years. And then we'll be doing the polarization measurements after that. Kendrick?
Do you have a sense for how that enhanced the contamination to temperature and structure that we experience, like mass activity?
So we should talk about that offline. So my impression when I did this was that it was very small. And that's what came out of a lot of the simulations that I was running on at the time. So the KSZ, so the problem with the KSZ for some context is it has the same frequency dependence as the primary CMB. So it is a problem. If the KSZ has a significant non-Gaussianity, it's not something that you can remove with multi-frequency observations, unlike all of these things that are on the plot. Now, at the time that we did this, it seemed like that was much, much smaller. The KSZ seemed consistent with the Gaussian random field for the purpose of the trispectrum that the lensing reconstruction is giving you. Now, I'm not sure how to reinterpret that statement in light of the work you've done recently, where you found actually that the KSZ is modulated by these very large-scale bulk flows, and its amplitude can change at the order of 10% when you're looking along different lines of sight. Does that make sense? It might be what? Sorry? Right. That's right. So a lot of your signal to noise actually comes from smaller scales than what we'd be using to try to do this lensing. But for halo lensing, trying to look at the lensing by dark matter halos, you do want to go to smaller scales. So there it could actually matter, I suppose. But I think it would be interesting to take some of the semi-analytic treatments for the KSZ and crank it through to see the impact here. It seemed like you went the other direction, where you took the lensing signal and saw how much it would impact the KSZ measurement in the 4-point. Yeah.
All right. Let's thank you again. We'll go to lunch.
Thank you.